You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. He's an author, a true ecologist, mountain climber. You've probably seen his work as a filmmaker. Michael Charles Tobias created the 1991 Voice of the Planet series for Turner Broadcasting, with William Shatner as host, no less. He's done a slew of documentaries since then, including Hotspots for PBS. Tobias is equally well known, though, in the animal rights and conservation movement, where he's received awards and accolades for his work. He leads the Dancing Star Foundation, devoted to species preservation. Now, Michael has teamed up with Stanford's Dr. Paul Ehrlich for a deep conversation in the book Hope on Earth. Michael, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. I'm really honored to be on your show, Alex.
California's been burning, temperature records falling. Surely people there must be wondering whether it's climate change and whether the state will be so pleasant if the world gets hotter. What are you hearing?
Well, of course, there's not a kid on the block who hasn't heard the phrase climate change. The nuances, of course, are myriad, but we're all now part of a singular issue, which, as Al Gore said years ago, is the issue of the 21st century, namely ecological literacy and survival. So everyone's talking about it, everyone's part of the problem, everyone can be part of the solution.
And people are still buying new cars, new trucks, they're going for oil in the most extreme places. Do you have any ideas when this deadly bubble will either pop or turn around?
Interesting question, Alex. I mean, let's look at British Columbia for a second. You have one of the lowest fertility rates in the world, certainly the lowest in Canada, just over 1.4. And yet you've got one of the worst legacies of watershed destruction in any country on the planet. You've got two out of the three most endangered mammals in North America in British Columbia, and yet a very small population growth. That said, like Tasmania, I mean, British Columbia has had a fantastic record in terms of Green Party politics, in terms of environmental awareness, and yet with 94% of your land owned by the Crown, you've not been able to protect very well the Ursus Americanus Kermode, the spirit bear, which numbers in the wild well over 400, and of course the Vancouver Island marmot, Marmota vancouverensis, which is probably, after the Pacific pocket mouse here in Southern California, the most endangered mammal in North America. So there are strange contradictions in terms of when the bubble will burst, what kinds of corollaries and equations and extrapolations we're making with respect to the impact that all of us consumers have. I can't answer it in terms of when. I can certainly, and I'm happy to discuss some of the potential outcomes of the crisis we all find ourselves in.
Before we get to that, how did you hook up with Paul Ehrlich?
Paul and I have known each other for a long time. He's been in three films that I've directed, and we share and have shared really since the 60s, although he's about 20 years older than I am, a deep, deep commitment to finding practical solutions to very gnarly and seemingly intractable problems vis-a-vis human nature and our impact on the global commons. So we first met face-to-face in the early 80s when I did a short documentary on extinction that included he and his wife, Ann Ehrlich, who had written a very good book on extinction with that title. Then we did a project, I directed a feature film called No Vacancy. Paul had a very important appearance in that film. Then we did a three-hour series that Dancing Star produced called State of the Earth. He and John Hart, who appears at the end of our book from UC Berkeley, a brilliant scientist, that's what sort of triggered the idea that Paul and I should actually do a book together. And the notion of a conversation, as Jared Diamond said in his lovely back cover comment, really is a platonic ideal to bring out, you know, the different prospects that two individuals with very different attitudes and orientations but common themes might be able to share and shed light on.
Both of you have done some work about human population, but the thing that bugs me is that almost all the population discussions are about what humans are doing for humans, and the animals are just left out of the equation and what's happening to them. Is there anybody speaking about overpopulation versus animals?
I have for 40 years, in at least 30 books of mine and probably 40 or 50 films of mine. and all the colleagues of mine who've been in those projects, part of those projects, most notably my wife and partner, Jane Gray Morrison, and this is what Dancing Star Foundation does. I think a lot of people, including organizations like World Watch, have focused heavily on impacts. I think you're right to say, and I would conclude and agree with you, that very few are making the connection between population, the human species, this traditional, almost religiously inbred notion of our superiority over the rest of the creation, and animal rights. I'm deeply focused, Dancing Star Foundation is deeply focused on that issue. And I'm happy to say that even randomly you might think, but not so, this week's Fortune magazine, in their article on water, very boldly puts up front the price of a cheeseburger in terms of water, 968 gallons. Now, that may seem suddenly, well, what does that have to do with animals and animal rights or other species? Of course, it has everything to do with other species, because the vast majority of that water abstraction is going into raising mammals, in this case bovines, that will be slaughtered for consumption, human consumption. And we've always put that under the table. You know, it's been said many, many times by colleagues of mine like Ingrid Newkirk and many others, Mark Beckoff, Jane Goodall, that, you know, if there were windows on every slaughterhouse in the world, that would be it. People would stop eating meat. I don't know if that's true or not, because we just heard a statistic in the last couple of days that came from the Anti-Defamation League suggesting that in a very comprehensive poll of over 110 countries, more than 51% of those surveyed said that, in their belief, there was no Holocaust in World War II. It was made up, that Anne Frank was a hoax. So if the most outrageous, horrific atrocity in documented human history is now believed by the majority of human beings to be a myth, what are we to make about their potential for ameliorating suffering when it comes to the more than 100 billion, that's with a B as in boy, 100 billion animals that are slaughtered for our unnecessary convenience and or taste bud pleasure, our quick fix, if you will, annually. I mean, this is a really critical core issue. And that's really why Paul Ehrlich and I, in our book Hope on Earth, started out with this Parmenides kind of Platonic dialogue, which really is about the one versus the many. And how do you reconcile the wishes of the one versus the needs of the many?
Well, you raised so many issues I'd like to take up there. I mean, just for example, I look up overpopulation on YouTube, and right at the top are a whole series of people, starting with talk show bad boy Alex Jones, saying overpopulation is a myth designed to exert global control. And so what is it about humans? We lie to ourselves about the most obvious things, whether it's population, what's happening to the animals, global warming. And the fringe deniers seem to get as many viewers and listeners as the sane people do. It's very frustrating.
Well, look at your own country. I mean, Canada, for the third year in a row, as all of your listeners will know, has seen its total fertility rate, the number of kids being born per couple, declining to a national average, I believe, of about 1.63, something like that. And BC is number one after I think, Newfoundland and Nova Scotia. So the commentators I've read on the Canadian front are all in unison with regard to, oh, dear, we're not replacing ourselves. We're going to have a gigantic crisis with regard to the social security net, with regard to supply demand and workers in the workforce, et cetera, et cetera. All the same issues you're seeing in the million shades of gray, so to speak, in Japan and China and throughout parts of Europe. Well, I mean, we have gone from the time of Karl Marx in 1850 to the present. We have multiplied ourselves well over sevenfold. Even at the medium level, United Nations projections, we will hit 9.5 billion by mid-century. If we continue at present trends, notwithstanding the great fertility restraint in British Columbia and Albania and a few places like that, we're going to exceed 12 to 13 billion Homo sapiens, which is odd because, you know, sapiens suggests that we're really smart as primates, but in fact, we're really self-destructive. Because everyone, and you can't blame them. We all want the same thing. We want cool air, the solace of shade under a tree. We want fresh drinking water. We want a quality of life. We want dignity. We want employment. We want a number of things, and everyone wants the same thing. We are genetically the same. We're one. So those who would argue that overpopulation is a non-issue, and they do, in fact, as you point out, Alex, dominate the world media. They dominate economic thinking. I like to recall one of my favorite philosophers, Bertrand Russell, who once said that most Americans, for example, would rather commit suicide than learn about mathematics. People don't want to learn about the numbers. And in fact, neurologists who've studied the brain have come up with the conclusion that we're much better at adding numbers than subtracting numbers. So it's much easier to add up 1 + 1 than to subtract 1 + 1 for some reason. So we're not good at looking at the opportunities of shrinking our population. We're much better at figuring out how many more cars can be sold if we have another million consumers. This is a big problem.
It sure is. Well, now this leads us to your book about Hope on Earth, and you told me that you were thinking about putting a question mark after that title. Why didn't you?
I think both Paul Ehrlich and myself are of the opinion that we want to encourage, inspire, hopefully enthrall people, colleagues, friends, newcomers to the work, as opposed to undermining and daunting and chilling them to the point of inertia. There'd be no point you and I having this conversation if we thought there was no hope. But it is a point of conversation. It is not a done deal. And hence the question mark is a very reasonable concept because we've got a lot of work to do. The tipping points are happening from the boreal forests in Canada to the Antarctic. We're seeing the demise of the largest number of species in the documented annals of biology, which is 4.1 billion years. We're also seeing the largest loss of species per year. Approximately 16 million populations are going extinct every year. That means a pod of whales or a flock of birds. So it's not just the hundreds and hundreds of species that are going extinct every day. We don't even know how many. But the question mark is this. If you are of the belief, as I am, and I know Paul is, that biodiversity is critical, that as Aristotle echoed in his whole body of works, he was, after all, a brilliant and one of the first great biologists in Western history, if the Earth is our mother, we came from her, we will return to her, that's for sure, then we need to revere her, we need to honor her, we need to give back, not just take. And we are a species of bipedal carnivorous Homo sapiens, one of the most heavy, if not the heaviest, impact species in history, who may have the shortest epitaph in history, which is a curious paradox. It's the paradox of progress. It's the tragedy of the commons, as biologist Garrett Hardin at UC Santa Barbara said in 1968 in one of the most heavily cited papers and phrases in the history of ecology. We really need to revere every living species. Sentience matters. And why I believe there is hope in the midst of this absolutely insane crisis that we're up against, that we're causing singularly, the hope is vested in the fact that never before have so many people wanted to be part of the solution. So you could look at the flip side of the population explosion and say, hey, look, we've got a billion young people now who want to be philanthropists, who want to make a difference, who want to emulate the Bill and Melinda Gateses of the world and really try to solve these major issues that are afflicting so many living beings, not just our own species. And that's really the bottom line.
Yeah, that word hope has been so abused. Some people actually turn away from anybody talking about it, much less promising it. And, you know, you'd sell more books if you called it the catastrophe that's coming or something. But I wonder, when we talk to young people, and I'm sure you do, what kind of hope can we offer them?
Any 8-year-old, any 6-year-old, any 4-year-old, really, can become a philanthropist. And they are. When they extend their olive branch in the form of helping someone across the street, saving a friend from getting hurt or hit on the head, they are, in fact, replicating, I believe, that compassion which is hardwired into us. I'm a firm believer in the notion that commensalism, symbiosis, biophilia, physiology, the love of nature, all of the good things that human nature does espouse and has espoused since time immemorial are real. If you go back to northern Iraq, as it is today, geopolitically, and look at Shanidar IV, one of the cave sites 60,000 years ago, it's the earliest known evidence of what we call conscience, or what the Greeks knew as synderesis, the act of compassion. There's a person, a skull, that was found in the 50s by a group from Columbia University in New York with a tiara of dried wildflowers on the skull. It's very likely that a son buried his father and put flowers on his head 62,000 years ago. We're capable of Bach's St. Matthew Passion, of Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel, of Vermeer's Girl with a Pearl Earring, of chocolate chip cookies and frisbees. And I really believe that the soul speaks when it's spoken to, and children give their best when given a chance. And evolution, by the way, in my opinion, does not condemn or liberate us. Only our choices can do that. So if we can raise a young generation of people who are focused on nonviolence or ahimsa, on compassion. I mean, we've experimented with war and violence and techniques of violence for thousands of years. It's time to explore and teach nonviolence. And that's what environmentalism is about. It's not just about housekeeping, if you want to transliterate the Greek. It's really about nonviolence. And that means to every living creature. It may seem symbolic at times if you save a spider from the bathtub, but it's not just symbolic. It's very real to that spider. And that's my point. Biodiversity has a conscience. Animals are self-aware. They dream. They're brilliant. We don't know that they're not infinitely smarter than we are. They certainly have caudal tails and residual stories, and they're not just biologies, they're biographies. And when we really understand and feel that, I think it's going to redirect the climate talks in Paris, for example, at the end of 2015. It's going to redirect our ethical address of what we're doing as a singular species to this planet. And so if you reach out to every individual life form that you encounter in any given day and decide, okay, that crow is my friend. That worm, that nameless little worm, is my friend. If we take that attitude, I think the whole world could be different.
I'm going to go with what you said. Do you have a website, a Facebook page, or a Twitter feed that people can follow?
Absolutely. www.dancingstarfoundation.org. And my personal website is www.michaeltobias.org. And I would welcome, we certainly welcome donations at our foundation based in California and New Zealand. And we certainly welcome dialogue and invigorating ideas for solutions. We do give out grants here and there, but we're primarily an operating foundation. We have rescued animals on our sanctuaries, and we're rescuing endangered species in places like New Zealand, where we operate a scientific reserve adjoining the newest national park on Rockiura, or Stewart Island, the third major island of New Zealand. But that's how people can reach me.
Well, I'm going to put some links to all of that and some YouTube videos that you've done in my own blog at ecoshock.info, and I think people will follow up that way too. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. We've been talking with filmmaker, ecologist, and animal defender Michael Charles Tobias about the new book, Hope on Earth, A Conversation, co-authored with Stanford's Paul Ehrlich. Michael is president of the Dancing Star Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us. I've really enjoyed what you had to say.
Alex, it's an honor to be your guest.
Radio EcoShock.